Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States on September 11th, 1991.
Certain that we stand at a defining hour. Halfway around the world, we are engaged in a great struggle in the skies and on the seas and sands. We know why we're there. We are Americans, part of something larger than ourselves. For two centuries, we've done the hard work of freedom, and tonight, we lead the world in facing down a threat to decency and humanity. What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind, peace and security, freedom, and the rule of law. Such is a world worthy of our struggle and worthy of our children's future. If it is possible, I want to continue to build a lasting basis for U.S.-Soviet cooperation for a more peaceful future for all mankind. The triumph of democratic ideas in Eastern Europe and Latin America and the continuing struggle for freedom elsewhere, all around the world, all confirm the wisdom of our nation's founders. Tonight, we work to achieve another victory, a victory over tyranny and savage aggression.
Greetings and welcome to Mystery Babylon Radio on January 30th, 2013. Tonight we are continuing a series, All Roads Lead to Mystery Babylon, Part 5. My co-host, John Daniel, the author of Grand Design Exposed, has been giving us the roots of Mystery Babylon. I'd like to quote out of his book, Grand Design Exposed, a quote: "To many, history might be dry and boring. Yet if we have a burning desire to understand what is truth, then history becomes vibrant and alive. History sheds light on our present world and also gives understanding for the future. It is through history that we find our roots and has become the reason and object of why much of our history today has been thoroughly censored, so that our roots will be purposely obscured." Played on my mind here for the last 4 or 5 days because, when I was started studying 15 years ago, started studying some little bit of history, I asked myself, what are my roots? And I had an opportunity today to ask a friend what their roots were. And by asking the question, I realized that I hadn't been given any roots, though my parents and my grandparents had some roots, but it had been just left out of my life. But after studying history and connecting the dots, I understand my roots. I was raised a Lutheran. Martin Luther started the Reformation. My relatives go all the way back to Russia. And so what am I getting at here? Well, I asked a friend of mine, and they didn't have the answer. But you see, their roots were, they were raised Catholic. What we see going on today, and it's very prevalent today, we're going through real perilous times right now with what's going on, and they're trying to agitate civil unrest with the taking of the guns. Today I realized that my friend roots were not that they are today, but their roots led back to Rome, to the Dark Ages. Because see, the roots that we're studying go much further than Rome. But roots are so important, because I realized, talking to this party, that, in other words, their roots have been taken away. If the Americans today in this country went back to their roots, they would be understanding why they're losing all their rights and freedoms. Because the New World Order that's coming upon us is not a New World Order. It's just the old World Order reinstated. And with that, John, I'm going to kind of put you on the spot. What are your roots?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, that's a very good question. But for an answer, to me, it's very easy, very simple. And, you know, to go along with what you have just shared with the listeners here, I wanted to start what I'm getting ready to give you an answer for is, according to the Word of God, God's people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. And you see that when you don't have that knowledge, then obviously you're not going to have understand where your roots are. And so once we start gaining this knowledge, then you see this. You know, when you talk about Catholic, and I bring that word in. And because the same word, Catholic, you know, your introduction with the President of the United States, he talked about a universal desire for the whole world. In other words, it's something that all mankind wants. Well, you see, the word Catholic means universal. And you come to understand when you start seeking this knowledge that there's a universal religion, one for good and one for evil. And so the God I serve, by the grace of God, is my roots. And this God has given to us His Word, the written Word. We weren't fortunate enough to live during those days when the living Word was here on this earth and visited mankind. But I'll tell you what, I'm going to tell you something. We're living in a day that outshines the day when the living Word actually walked. Because what we're looking at right now is the day when that living Word is going to come back here to this planet a second time. And that's what all of the prophets that you read there in that book, Word, that God has given to us as a written Word, looked forward to. And how many people today on this planet even have an idea what I'm even talking about right this moment? Very, very few. And so, what our purpose here in these presentations is to know this God this true and living God, and to know the enemy of this God. And this is what we've been delving into, you see, because this picture is so big, and unless you have all of the pieces, you will never see the full picture. And that picture is awesome once you see it. And so, God has given us, in His written word, through these prophets, down through the ages, that only the true God and living God could do. There is not another religion on this planet that can predict even 1 minute ahead in the future, much less hundreds and thousands of years. And this is what I've been trying to portray with these presentations, because when you understand what God, how He has intervened and interfered, and all the issues of men, and He has given us understanding, He has confronted the enemy in many, many occasions. And you see, He declares to the world, to the universe, that He is the creator of all things. And so that makes Him king of all kings. But it seems on this planet, that kingship has been usurped. And this is what we want to get into here. And I want to continue here this evening and dwell a little bit longer on Babylon, the kingdom of Babylon. And when we talk about these kings, what we're trying to portray and to make known vividly is that these kings are not the ordinary kings that we read about in the medieval times, several hundred years ago. These were kings that were not ashamed to portrayed to the world. They did not live their life incognito. They boldly declared to the world who they were and what they were and what they represented. And be assured, the extravagance, the luxury, the eloquency of their lifestyle is something that is known in history as seven wonders of the world. That's the type of living and structures that they produced in their living at that position that was a position that was recognized by the whole world. It was truly recognized by the whole world. And it has been handed down from generation to generation. It's like a dynasty. And as we get into this thing completely and see the whole picture, it's an awesome picture. It's an awesome picture. And this is what we're trying to portray here and to make known so that those that are listening in can understand this just a little bit better. And so I'm pausing here again a little bit on Babylon, because you see, Babylon literally becomes a metaphor for Rome. And you see, Babylon, in all of its glory, and all of its splendor collapsed. And I'm going to share something here, and I got to do it very quickly because the time just flies here. You know, when you talk about 40 minutes or so, you don't get too far. So I'm going to go in, and what I want you to do, I'm going to read about the glory of this kingdom of Babylon that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, produced. And I want you to close your eyes, not to go to sleep, I hope, but just to concentrate on what's being read here. And I'm reading from a book. It's a fascinating book. And if anyone would like to understand how to get this book, it's not for sale, it's out of print. This book was written in 1943. It's a very unique book. It's called Wonders of the Past. It's the size of a typewriter piece of paper, 8.5 by 11. It's like almost two inches thick. And it's fully not illustrations. It is photographs. It shows excavations. These people that have contributed to this book are professors, and they're very professional scientists, archaeologists, and it's just an awesome book. And many of the photographs are even in color. What I'm going to read here is a chapter called The Hanging Gardens of Babylon. So sit tight. You're in for a treat. Believe me. It says, a jewel depends for its beauty largely upon its cutting and the manner of its setting. The case of a monument or of a building is so similar. However beautiful the structure may be itself, its glory is enhanced by its associations and environment. In order, therefore, fully to appreciate the splendor of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, are counted among the seven wonders of the world, we must try to visualize them in their proper surroundings, actual and historical. Babylonia was the first of the great kingdoms of Western Asia. With the exception, perhaps, of Egypt, it was the first of the great kingdoms of the earth. The writer of the book of Genesis called the country the land of Shinar. There, Nimrod, the mighty hunter, we are told, began to be a mighty one in the earth, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And Erech, and Akkad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar. Also in Genesis, we learn that out of that land he went forth into Assyria and built it Nineveh. Just think about that. That's Nimrod now doing all this. I hope you understand who Nimrod is. We'll get to that one very soon. Not in this presentation, but anyhow, it goes on to say, for several centuries, Assyria, the land of Assur, with Nineveh as its chief city, remained, if not actually a province, at least a dependency of Babylonia. But in the 9th century B.C., the Assyrians achieved independence, and at last, about 745 B.C., under the mighty Tiglath-Pileser III, they vanquished their former overlords and absorbed Babylonia in their empire. The proud city of Babylon then fell from its high estate. Nineveh became the glory of kingdoms. The triumph of Nineveh endured for rather more than a century. Medes had long been gathering in the mountains to the east. The ever-rebellious Babylonians entered into a league with these Medes, and in 606, they fell upon Nineveh and destroyed the city so utterly that until archaeologists began to excavate in modern times, all knowledge even of its site was lost. With the fall of Nineveh began the Second Babylonian Empire, the Empire of Nebuchadnezzar, and then were built the famous Hanging Gardens. Nebuchadnezzar, in his spectacular manner, characteristic of the East, to design them to honor and delight his beautiful Median queen, daughter of Cyaxares. That prince whose arms and whose loyal support had raised his house to power. An old Greek story has assigned to the gardens an earlier date, according to this story, and they were built by Semiramis. Now, Semiramis was the wife and mother of Nimrod, the beautiful, voluptuous, and wholly mythical Assyrian queen, whose tradition has proclaimed as the founder of both Nineveh and Babylon and all of their wonders. Nineveh, in the days of its splendor, had been a vast and wonderful city. Nebuchadnezzar proposed to raise a new Babylon, which should be greater and more wonderful still. He achieved his purpose. The city of Nebuchadnezzar, built for the most part by master craftsmen brought as slaves from Nineveh, amazed all who beheld it. According to the Greek historian Herodias, the father of history, who lived in the 5th century BC, the city was laid out in the form of a square, with the broad Euphrates flowing through its midst. In other words, it flowed right through the middle of the city. Each side of the square was 15 miles long, and the whole was surrounded by a wall. Now listen to the size of this wall. 350 feet high and 87 feet thick, in which there are said to have been 100 gates, all of brass with brazen lintels and side posts. That's 25 gates per side. And the models within these gates? Babylon was not a city as we think of cities today, not a place where men lived herded in narrow streets and gloomy squares. Its gorgeous temples, palaces, and halls stood in stately parks. There were great hunting grounds in its midst. It was a place of extravagance beyond ordinary computation and of wicked luxury, and the pride and the undoing of an arrogant and conquering race. I just want to pause here just for a minute. Just remember now, just remember, the king was the god, the sun god, in the flesh. He had to live an outward life that represented who he was and who he represented. So all of this eloquent luxury and magnificence of his work is portrayed for all of those who come even close to him or in his presence are overwhelmed by the incredible lifestyle that he was living. The city itself is described in another, if we can place any trust in the account of all writers, it must have been the most wonderful of them all, and recent excavations have gone far to confirm the seemingly fabulous stories handed down to us. But in all of Babylon, there was no building to rival the Hanging Gardens. Of this, all who saw and described the city are unanimous. The framework of the gardens were made largely of stone. That is not their least remarkable features. The Hanging Gardens were the only Babylonian structure in which huge stone was used to any considerable extent. And if it is hard for us to appreciate the limitations under which architects worked in the basin of the Tigris and Euphrates, hold on a minute. I'm going to play it to you real quick. And the Tigers and the Euphrates, where, in the words of Professor Myers, a stone door socket was a rich gift of a king to his god, and was rescued from one ruin after another to be reused and proudly rededicated, it is still harder for us to imagine whence, and at what cost, all the stone that must have been required for the garden was obtained. In point of grandeur and immensity, the Hanging Gardens cannot be compared with Nebuchadnezzar's colossal palace, or with the temple of the god Bel Merodach. Bel is another name, a Babylonian name, for Baal, Babylon's protecting deity. In other words, it was absolutely, positively sun worship. A towering, eight-story structure crowned with the two vast golden-laden shrines. But for beauty, grace, and charm, they were unmatched. They occupied a square and a circuit of rather more than a quarter of a mile, immediately to the northeast of the principal court of the royal palace. The use of the term hanging in connection with these gardens is, though generally accepted, in many ways unfortunate. The word gives a false impression, and is not a fair translation either, of the Greek chrismestos or of the Latin pensilus. To the Romans, pensilus conveys the idea of balconies. Balconies raised one above another. That is exactly what the Hanging Gardens were. They comprised, in fact, a series of wide stone terraces supported by arches and rose like a giant stairway to the height of 350 feet. The whole structure being strengthened by a surrounding wall 20 feet thick. On each of the terraces was a layer of mold so deep as to make it possible not only for the plants and flowering shrubs to be green, but fruit-bearing trees as well. The gardens were irrigated by means of hydraulic pumps, which raised water to a reservoir on the highest terrace. On top of the numerous articles, the builders laid reeds and bituminum, and above these, thick sheets of lead. This served to prevent moisture from the soil leaking through and so damaging the spacious and superbly decorated apartments constructed in the vault spaces between the arches below. A wide flight of steps ascended from each terrace to the one above. Picture these lofty terraces, their many arches festooned with flowering creepers, and all the platforms ablaze with the most gorgeously scented and colored flowers which Asia, indeed, the then-known world, could produce. Shaded from the too hot sun, the trees laden with their seasons and with rich and luscious fruits, picture in the paradise and oriental luxury in the heart of Great Babylon, the Median queen holding her splendid court, then you will be able to appreciate something of the glamour and glory of the Hanging Gardens. Now in imagination, mount the wide staircase up to the relentless glare and cruel heat of the long Mesopotamian summer into the shade of one of those arched chambers furnished with exquisite treasures of Eastern art. Sink on a soft divan and feel the dry, hot air blowing deliciously cool upon you through the continuously watered vegetation without, while minstrels make soft music, while slaves anticipate your slightest wants, while life in the great city throbs below, then surely you will call the Hanging Gardens a wonder, a conception worthy of a king who was feared and respected as the greatest monarch upon the earth. What remains of the Hanging Gardens? More than is commonly supposed. Excavations carried out in 1903 brought to light in a square immediately to the northeast of the ruins of Nebuchadnezzar's great palace, a vaulted crypt or cellar, the foundation of a building holy and light, any other traced on the site of ancient Babylon. An evidence survives that the stone was used extensively in its construction. Inscriptions on the tablets found on the stairway leading to the crypt suggest that these cellars once served as refrigerators, as places for preserving perishable foods. On either side of the central passage are the remains of seven vaulted chambers, closely resembling to the design the arched apartments of the Hanging Gardens of legend. This quadrangle is surrounded by a thick wall, and outside this on the earth, on the north and east, separated from it by a narrow corridor, is another series of chambers. There is little doubt that the masonry once served to support the fairy palace built as a symbol of love by the king who led the Hebrews into captivity and who is the best known to all the historic characters of the long, long ago. The position of the ruins, their construction, and the size all point to this one conclusion. And the sunrise and the surmise, is supported by evidence which appears to be still more convincing. In one of the outer chambers there is, to quote from the authoritative work, the excavation, this is a quote, the excavations at Babylon by Henry Conway. A well which differs from all other wells known in Babylon or elsewhere in the ancient world. It has three shafts placed close to each other, a square one in the center and an oblong ones on each side, an arrangement for which I can see no other explanation than a mechanical hydraulic machine stood here, which worked on the same principle as our chain pump. This contrivance would provide a continuous flow of water. How strange that this utilitarian detail should be the only surviving proof that the Hanging Gardens once existed and all the glory with which legend has invested them. With all that glory, I must tell you that the Word of God, the Word of the true and living God, prophesies to Jeremiah the prophet that these things would be destroyed. This city was to be destroyed. And I read from the book of Jeremiah, chapter 51, verses 1 through 18. And then I will read another set, 54 to 64. It reads, as I quote, "Thus saith the Lord, Behold, I will raise up against Babylon, and against them that dwell in the midst of them, that rise up against me, a destroying wind, and will send unto Babylon fanners that shall fan her, and shall enter her land, for in the day of the trouble they shall be against her round about. Against him that bendeth, let the archer bend his bow, and against him that lifteth himself up against his brigandine, and spare ye not her young men, destroy ye utterly all her host. Thus the slain shall fall in the land of the Chaldeans, and they that are thrust through in her streets. For Israel hath not been forsaken, nor Judah of his God, of the Lord of hosts, though their land was filled with sin against the Holy One of Israel. Flee out of the midst of Babylon." And these words I'm reading right now, it's almost echoed when you read the book of Revelation about a Babylon, another spiritual Babylon. "Flee out of the midst of Babylon and deliver every man his soul. Be not cut off in her iniquity. For this is the time of the Lord's vengeance. He will render unto her a recompense. Babylon hath been a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken her of her wine. Therefore the nations are mad. Babylon is suddenly fallen. and destroyed. Howl for her. Take balm for her pain. If so, she may be healed. We would have healed Alan, but she is not healed. Forsake her and let her go, every one, into his own country. For her judgment reaches unto heaven and is lifted up even to the skies. The Lord hath brought forth our righteousness. Come and let us declare in Zion the work of the Lord our God. Make bright the arrows, gather the shields. The Lord hath raised up the spear of the kings of the Medes for his devices against Babylon, to destroy it, because it is the vengeance of the Lord, the vengeance of his temple. Set up the standard upon the walls of Babylon. Make the watch strong. Set up the watchmen. Prepare the ambushes, for the Lord hath been both devised and done that which he spoke against the inhabitants of Babylon. O thou that dwellest among many waters, abundant in treasures, thy end is come, and the measure of thy covenant is. The Lord of hosts has sworn by himself, saying, surely I'll fill thee with men as with caterpillars, and they shall lift up a shout against thee. He made the earth by his power. He has established the world by his wisdom, and has stretched out the heavens by his understanding. When he uttereth his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens, and he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightning with rain, and bringeth forth the wind out of his treasures. Every man is brutish by his knowledge. Every founder is confounded by the graven image. For his molten image is falsehood, and there is no breath in them. They are vanity and the work of errors. In the time of their visitation, they shall perish. Bear with me a minute here. I'm reading now verses 54. A sound of a cry cometh from Babylon, and great destruction from the land of the Chaldeans, because the Lord hath spoiled Babylon, and destroyed out of her the great force, when her waves do roar like great waters, and the noise of their voice is uttered, because the spoilers are come upon her, even upon Babylon, and her mighty men are taken, every one their bows is broken, for the Lord God of recompenses shall surely requite. And I will make drunk her princes and her wise men, her captains, her rulers, and her mighty men, and they shall sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake, saith the King, whose name is the Lord of hosts. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the broad walls of Babylon shall be utterly broken, and her high gates shall be burned with fire, and the people shall labor in vain, and the folk in the fire, and they shall be weary. The word which Jeremiah, the prophet, commanded Sariah, the son of Nero, the son of Messiah, when he went with Zedekiah, the king of Judah, into Babylon, the fourth year of his reign. And this Sariah was a quiet prince. So Jeremiah wrote in a book all the evil that should come upon Babylon, even all those words that are written against Babylon. And Jeremiah said to Sariah, when thou comest to Babylon and shall see, and shall read all these words, then shalt thou say, O Lord, thou hast spoken against this place to cut it off, that none shall remain in it, neither man nor beast, but that it shall be desolate forever. And it shall be, when thou hast made an end of reading this book, that shall bind a stone to it, and cast it in the midst of the river Euphrates. And thou shalt say, thus shall Babylon sink, and shall not rise, from the evil that I will bring upon her, and they shall be weary. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah. To give you a little idea, dear listeners, I bring to you, again, I go back to this book that is such an incredible book. I read now, and I probably won't hardly have time to finish it. In fact, I know I won't. I'm going to read. I cannot read. I must stop because I don't have time. What I want to say is, these world empires that God has given us a picture of in the book of Revelation, I re-enter it. I re-enter it. And God has said that there's a dragon that has seven heads. This dragon is known as Lucifer, or Satan, or the devil. Those seven heads represent the world empires of this, that put these gorgeous, incredible, amazing wonders to look at. And you see these pictures and illustrations in this book, it's just awesome, literally awesome to see. To be there must be something else. And God has given us that understanding that these seven heads are the seven world empires of this sun worship system that has opposed God ever since they came into existence. But God also tells us, in the time of the last world empire, God is going to intervene, and he will begin to place his own empire here that will never, never end. And we, as God's people, are invited to become citizens of that kingdom. And by the grace of God, by the grace of God, you will search out the words that are being presented here to understand these things as truth, so that you can prepare yourself in your heart with all your love for your Lord who has given you redemption to be in that city, in that great kingdom that he's going to prepare for us. There is absolutely, if we miss that, we have missed everything. Everything. Because there's nothing that comes close to comparing. And this is what our Lord spoke when he left his disciples. And the words that he spoke to his disciples were meant for all of those down to the very end of time when our Lord shall return. The second time that he's coming to pick and get his bride. He says, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself. That where I am, there you may be also. I pray by the grace of God that one day I will meet you there. We have a wonderful and loving God. Believe me, there is a true and living God. Even though the whole world today is trying to push that God out of our comprehension and in our understanding.
Okay, John, we're almost out of time. Would you like to just say a little bit what you're going to cover next week?
Next week, I'm going to finish what I was wanted to read tonight. And it's only going to take but a few minutes. But from that point on, I'm going to ask a question right this moment. Do you folks understand where the Atlantic Ocean got its name? I want to bring those things to you. Believe me, this is all part of the picture. And it's an incredible picture once you start seeing these things. It's an awesome picture. And after next week, we're going to get into the Greek mythology, and we're going to study that for the presentation. So,
okay,
God bless, and I'll see you next week.
Okay, dope. We'll see you next week.
I got a poor starting life, heading downhill real fast. Can't see the future, ain't recalling the past. I'm at the crossroad of life, stuck on the tracks. I can't go forward and I ain't going back. But there's a light at the end of the tunnel, they say. You just got to live life day by day. Keep the faith, hold your head high, soar like an eagle and fly. but neglect in my family, I lost all my friends. Can't tell you where the day starts, don't know where it ends. I burnt all my bridges and spent my last dime. I've got my life on hold for an indefinite time, but there's a lot.